From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education, here with Dan Schwartz, dean of the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford.
Great to see you, Denise.
Thanks. How you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah.
So we're talking about education and law today?
We are talking about education and law, and I have a little stump, Dan, question for you.
Okay. Doesn't this usually work the other way?
Yeah, it does, but I decided to mix it up today, so we'll see how this works. It's not really a hard question, but the second part of it is harder than the first. Okay, so here's the first part. Are you ready?
Okay.
Here's the first part. What do the following things all have in common? Pledge of Allegiance, peanut allergies, Amish families, and bathrooms.
My son.
Wait, how is that possible?
He engages in none of those.
Oh, okay. All right. So the answer is that there's been lawsuits brought on these topics that are hugely famous, or some are really kind of tiny.
Peanut allergies?
Peanut allergies.
Wow.
Yeah. So let's just go through each one and see if you can guess what the suit would be about.
Is this the hard part?
This is the harder part.
Okay.
I'll help you.
Okay.
So Pledge of Allegiance.
The parents don't want their child to pledge allegiance?
That is right. Why not?
Because they don't believe in the United States.
Probably not that, but it's controversial, especially when it has the word God in it. And I don't know about you. I used to say the Pledge of Allegiance every day at school. Did you?
Do you remember?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I was always the one who never got that indivisible. I always said invisible.
Yeah, I was sort of like, I pledge allegiance to the United States. I was very good at pretending.
Yeah. So I think most people kind of think of it as a throwaway, but some families take it really seriously, as is their right to do so, and do not want their kid to be forced to say that. So that was a pretty big...
So it was under religion?
It was religion, yes. Now you're getting into beyond my knowledge.
Okay,
we'll have to ask
our
guest about that. Okay, so peanut allergies.
My child's allergic to peanuts, and he got sick because some other child brought it, and I want my child to be in a safe place.
Yeah, right. Peanut-free zones. This is a very big deal right now. And should we force the school to have it, and, you know, use of EpiPens and all of that? So that's a serious...
All I care about is I'm one for two.
You're doing well, Dan. You're so competitive. Yes. Amish families.
They want to have religion in school. No. They didn't want to have technology in school.
This case is old. I'm sure there are new cases about technology, so that would be interesting. And we can ask our guest about that, too. But to my knowledge, there are certain things that the school teaches that the Amish family didn't want to be compulsory for their kid to go to.
Like evolution.
Well, you know, there is a bunch of families out there. Yeah, that's a big controversy, evolution versus creationism. The state of Texas has a huge issue over curriculum and what gets put into required curriculum and textbooks and whatnot. So lots of legal issues.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. One for three.
What was the fourth? Did I even ask you a fourth?
Oh, so do I get a lost point for that,
you,
too?
I'll give you that. But for what I want to say is there's a ton of things that have to do with law and education, race and gender issues, employment issues, special education rights, and are there kids being served, bullying, discipline, athletics, Title IX. I mean, the list is really long when you go on these websites. Banned books, right? So there's a lot we can talk about today.
You know, I've been to court once.
Do we want to say this out loud to the public, what that was about?
I was a jury. I was on the jury.
I thought you were arrested.
No.
Oh, okay.
I've been to traffic school many times.
Yeah, you and me both, buddy.
So, you know, I haven't really bumped into the law except that my dad was a law professor and my brother was a lawyer. And our dinner table conversation was horrible, you know, because no matter what I said, they would pick. So I don't know much about the law in education. I'm very curious.
Well, I'm excited to bring our guest on.
Me too. And let me introduce him. We are lucky to have Bill Kosky with us today. He is a professor of law at Stanford, and he's the director of the Youth and Education Law Project, which they called Yelp, but they didn't brand it, and I think they regret that now. So welcome, Bill.
It's good to be here.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us. We have a bunch of questions for you. I think parents are fascinated with this topic. I think as a mom, my first question to you is, what are my rights as a parent? How do I know when I should contact a lawyer?
Wow, that's a huge question because it all depends on what the specific issue is and what the dispute might be. Going back to your pregame banter that you were just doing with Dan, one thing I'll say is that many of the hot button cultural issues and cultural disputes that we see out there find their way into school, as you can naturally imagine, whether it's issues around vaccinations or peanut allergies, sort of the small individual things, or some of the big topics like religion and exemption from certain curriculum. So it's not surprising that those disputes finding their way into schools ultimately find themselves in a courtroom. So when you get a lawyer, you know, it all depends on the specific issue. If you're a parent of a child with disabilities, pretty early on, you're apprised of what your rights and responsibilities are around the school to ensure that your child receives an appropriate education. If you're a parent who is the child who's being bullied, for instance, you might also at that point try to resolve it with the school in sort of non-dispute ways, but ultimately there may be a need to get a lawyer involved. If you're a parent who is experiencing some other form of concern at kind of the institutional level that your school is not treating groups of kids very well, you might try to resolve that again informally. And the one thing I would say about involving a lawyer, it's not a first resort. You shouldn't, you know, pick up the phone and call a lawyer. You should try to, first of all, work with your school officials and assume that everybody's operating in good faith, that everybody has all children's best interest at heart. And that would be my goal first. And then if things go in a direction that's not healthy, then you might consider finding an advocate or a lawyer.
So you had so many great things in there. I want to push on the bullying for a second. Mm-hmm. This is a true story. I know a kid. I know the mom of the bullier. And the bullier at school was asking kids for their homework and telling them that they needed to give him the answers to tests and whatnot or he would beat them up. And the mom of the bullying kid felt terrible and didn't know what to do and didn't think the school was even handling this in a way that was fair to her kid. The last thing on her mind was to get a lawyer and sue because she was the mom of the bullier. Right? But how do you even handle that when they come to you or talk about bullying and they're either the parent of the bullier or the bullied?
Yeah, it's such a complex issue. And even that anecdote brings out a lot of the complexities. So, for instance, that's kind of a story of classic bullying. Somebody says, I will hurt you in some way if you don't do something. Or they're, you know, constantly using maybe threats of physical violence or actually hitting kids. That's sort of the archetypal bully or something like that. But bullying operates on such a subtle level in schools nowadays with social media and ways that you can create online bullying. And a lot of that action actually happens off campus in, you know, the child's bedroom, but it has real effects in school. So as a school administrator or a teacher, how do you deal with these kinds of verbal bullying, these kinds of harassment that you might see online or that you might see in the hallways? You have to respond to it. You have to create a safe space for the so-called victims of bullying. And you have to also at the same time address the bad behavior of the bully. But you also have to remember that sometimes the bully might be a child who's dealing with stress or trauma or emotional disturbance or disabilities his or herself. And that's something that we have to take into account. Another word for bully in my world is client, because a lot of the people who are bullies who might do something wrong end up receiving some type of school discipline like suspension or expulsion. And the families might come to me for help to try to make sure that the punishment is commensurate with whatever the behavior was, or even maybe they didn't do it. At the same time, I want to create a safe space. It might be bullying based on disability, bullying based on gender identity, bullying based on being a female or something like that. These are the kinds of things that the law will protect. And so if a child is being bullied because of those characteristics, that ought to be addressed and ought to be addressed seriously.
So I'm a little confused in this, in that I'm not quite sure which things the school have responsibility for. So when I was in junior high, we waited at the bus stop for the bus to take us to the school, which is about 5 miles away. And there was a kid, a couple of kids, and they bullied all the seventh graders. And I was a seventh grader. Is the school responsible for that, or is this just, no, I should go after their parents?
Yeah, well, you're getting a bit into the weeds of the law because it all depends on which state or jurisdiction you're in, whether or not the school is responsibility. In the state that we are right now, in California, the school actually is responsible for conduct that happens going to or coming from school. So you would have been protected, and the school would have had to have acted there. I think it gets a lot harder when you have a situation where the bullying or the treatment is happening online somewhere. My brother's a principal, and so he gets this all the time because he sees the effects of it in school, a distraught child, sort of subtle things going on in the hallway, but he doesn't have anything to point to because the conduct isn't really happening at school. Now, does the school have a responsibility to deal with that? Maybe not in the sense that they can discipline the student, but maybe that they can create a safe environment or an understanding of how to use things like social media and how kids should be treating each other respectfully and in a safe way on campus. But sometimes they do have responsibility. Yeah. And at that bus stop, school should have been dealing
with that.
Dan,
you missed out on suing and getting millions of dollars.
It was a formative experience. And I had my revenge later.
Do we want to know what you did?
No, but, you know, it's 15 years later, one of us was doing better than the other.
Reunion.
Well,
reunion is right.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with our guest, Bill Koski. So, Bill, we've been talking about maybe when a parent should contact a lawyer. When should a teacher contact a lawyer? When do the teachers have rights, and when should they lawyer up?
So this is a great question. With my kid, we moved to a new city, and so he became class clown. And I got calls from the parent, from the teachers over and over and over. And eventually I got tired of it. And I said, I'm not going to do anything to fix this kid for you. They should have sued. They should have sued me for being a bad parent.
Bill, would you like to weigh in on that?
When should a teacher call a lawyer? Well, again, I'm going to give you my standard answer. It depends on what the problem is, right? But so teachers do have rights in school. Most of those rights revolve around their employment protections, whether it's through collective bargaining agreements, union arrangements, that they do have rights there, work rules and the like. They also have rights under state law to certain employment terms and that kind of thing. But they also do have some modest free speech rights. They do get some bandwidth to speak their mind, but ultimately they are employees of the school district and they are providing the school district's message to the children. So there are some limitations even on free speech rights. Now, in your case, Dan, not a lot that the teacher can do, but if you are not responding to the teacher over and over again, administration might have to get involved. I think I would run that up the flagpole to the leaders of the school and try to get you involved somehow. Now, ultimately, in the worst case scenario, and this was not you in it by any stretch, if there are clear signs that children are being neglected by parents, you obviously can get officials and authorities involved with that as a teacher. That would be a tragic situation, obviously. In terms of teachers and their safety at school, that has become an issue from time to time, as you can imagine, where they're, they may receive threats from students or perceived threats from students. In those instances, again, it's up to the institution, the school, the administration to take pretty active steps. And I will say in those situations, administrators are pretty quick to take action. They're not going to put their teachers at risk. They're not going to expose them to potential violence or anything like that.
I think in today's litigious society, I hear teachers saying, I'm afraid to give a bad grade because I'm going to get sued. My letter of recommendation affects whether a kid gets into college, and they're afraid to say honest negative things in there because of fear of lawsuits. Is this something that's come up in your work?
I think that they probably should have the school's lawyer come in and calm them down a bit. Teachers have a lot of discretion. Grading is sort of sacrosanct. That's one place where teachers have ultimate discretion. And, even taking it to the administration or, God forbid, the school board or something like that, you can't overturn a teacher's grade. That's your professional judgment. In terms of letters of recommendation, just be truthful. You're not going to expose yourself to anything as long as you're truthful.
I think there's those stories that get out there, this fear that, you waive the right to read it, and so they think it's confidential, but you always know the kid who sends it to himself or puts that other address on. And there's real fear on the part of teachers because the stakes are so high in the eyes of the families.
Yeah, and I can imagine that in some communities, there's real concern that parents, even just having a parent come into your classroom and make accusations like that, that's pretty traumatizing for a teacher, and that alone is problematic. But rising to the level of a legal problem, that would be a rare situation.
I'm pretty interested in special needs students, and you've described the system as adversarial, where the parents are put in a particular relationship and the child. Could you talk a little bit about, if I have a special needs child, how I think about this?
Yeah. So, the primary law protecting children with disabilities in school or providing rights to children with disabilities is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It's called the IDEA. And that law gives students, children who have disabilities, the right to a free and appropriate public education. That's a very vague term right there. But what it says is that the district has to make an individual plan to meet the needs of a child. She might have autism. She might have intellectual disability. She might have garden variety learning disabilities. Whatever those individual needs are, the school has to provide for those needs and give that child access to the general curriculum as much as possible, and to ensure that she's being integrated with children without disabilities to the extent possible. Now, problems sometimes arise because the law is set up in such a way that the parent is essentially the policeman and the prosecutor and everybody else to protect the rights of the child. So this creates a situation where it has to be the parent to go to these individualized education plan meetings, IEP meetings, to ensure that their child is getting the services that they need. And 99% of the time, these meetings go great because the school district officials and the parents get along well and they make a good plan for the child moving forward. It's on those occasions where there is a good faith dispute between the parent and the child where the parent then has rights to what's called due process. They can actually file for an administrative hearing and have a neutral judge, as it were, determine what is an appropriate education for the child. It's a very odd law. I can't think of many other places where you have a situation where the person has to be the policeman for her own rights or her child's rights in this instance. And it creates, you know, sort of difficulty because you don't want to have to stand up to a school district. You don't want to have to stand up to the child's teacher, this person who you entrust the care of your child with most of the day, right? So it's a very strange law.
So it could pit you against folks when really you're all supposed to be in there looking for the best interests of the kids. So it sounds like there's people like you out there with really good resources to offer parents and teachers in working to ensure that what's best for the kid is actually
That's right.
Through.
You know, and there are attorneys out there who specialize in representing kids with disabilities. For low-income folks, there are some legal organizations out there that will help them out on a pro bono or low bono basis. And once you get in that situation where you are in dispute with a school district, it's best to get yourself educated real quickly. There's lots of material available on the web. There's a website called Rights Law. There, in each state, there is an organization called Protection and Advocacy that puts out information and provides support for families of children with disabilities or own special education issues. I would look into those kind of resources.
Great. Thanks, Bill. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope speaking with Bill Cosby about the law.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back. This is Denise Pope. I'm here with Dan Schwartz, and our guest today is Bill Cosby. He's a law professor at Stanford, and we are talking about your rights as a parent, as a student, as a teacher. Dan, you have a question.
Well, I want to follow up. So if my child has special needs, then I can go to the school to make sure that those are being met. Now I have a situation where my child, I think something's going on at school. I'm not sure. He's coming back anxious or becoming more sullen or seeming to fall behind. Does the law have anything to say about this?
It's quite possible that the law might have something to say about this. What I would look for right away is there anything that I can point to medically, emotionally going on in the child's life, at home, with friends, to figure out, okay, can I maybe figure out what the cause of this is? Because any way that you can identify that, you can have a better conversation with the school people. Typically what happens is if a child starts struggling in school, it's the teacher who's going to notice it first. And they're going to call in Mr. Schwartz. You know, we noticed that your son is being very distracted in school. He seems to be disengaged from school. We want to be able to help him out. Maybe we can get together as a parent, as sometimes an administrator and a teacher, and let's make a plan for him. In the old days, and still currently, we call that a student success team, where they informally put together a plan with some minor interventions or accommodations, maybe some reminders when the student gets off task, if the student is daydreaming or something like that. Maybe it's preferential seating or something like that. These are kind of very modest interventions, and some schools do this as a matter of course on a school-wide basis. But if those interventions don't work, if the child continues to struggle, at that point a parent can request a special education assessment, and you try to identify where is the child struggling. So, for instance, if you've noticed real school avoidance or anxiety or I'm not going to school today, and it gets really hard to get your teenager to go to school, I mean not just the simple cutting stuff, but true fear of school, you're going to say, hey, I notice this behavior is happening at home or this emotional thing. Can we assess the child to see if she or he is having some sort of difficulty that might be disability-based? And the school district would do a full-blown assessment at that point, and you would get together as an individualized education plan team, IEP team, to determine whether or not they're eligible for special ed and what services could help them out, because there are great accommodations that can be made for that.
So I'm a parent, and I'm a little afraid of my child getting a label, you know, to go through this assessment thing. And suddenly what is a normal child who's got anxiety has suddenly been given a category.
Yeah, that is not an unwarranted fear for sure. I mean, stigma around some of these labels is pretty big, and there are a number of ways that you can possibly deal with that. You know, this is part of the purpose of that first intervention, that SST team, is to try to do whatever we can without moving towards a full-blown assessment and maybe that eligibility, which comes with a label sometimes. Having said that, we do want to remember that it's upwards of 13 or 14% of all children in the U.S. have a disability, an identified disability in school. So it's not a small number. 8% of those kids, or 8% of the kids overall, have a learning disability. This is, you know, garden variety stuff. Famous people like Charles Schwab and Oprah Winfrey have identified learning disabilities. So part of this is education and trying to ensure that that stigma doesn't attach. But I understand if it does. And in that case, some parents might opt for Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act plan, which provides a different set of accommodations, but you don't necessarily go into the special education world and have IEPs. Or you might choose to get services privately if you have the wherewithal and the funds to do that to support your child.
Well, and I think pediatrician is also a really nice resource if you're afraid to go to the school at first. I would hope that the pediatricians would be open to working with the schools. But I know as a teacher, there were definitely kids in my class who were on Ritalin, and it would have been really nice for me to know when they were staying at this parent's house and this parent doesn't give them their medication. So the more I know it's scary for parents to say, oh, my kid has a label and they don't want that to be carried with them. On the other hand, if we're all working towards what's best for the kids. As a teacher, I really need to know what's going on to be prepared for what's going to happen in my class when he doesn't take his medication, for instance.
Oh, so I hear you, Denise. I could imagine that being the case as a teacher. But for a parent who wants to protect their own privacy and their children's privacy rights, they don't really have to talk about medication. And it would really be sort of out of line for school district officials to recommend that a child be assessed or receive medication, or you ought to put your kids on Adderall or something like that. I get that in an ideal situation, you're all working together. And if there is that kind of comfort and trust, that's great. But at the same time, I do worry about folks pushing towards over-medication. We certainly see that in places like juvenile hall or, you know, when kids are wards of the state where there is a real problem with over-medication. So we don't want to tip too far that way either.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Bill Kosky. Right now, the conversation is about medication, ADD, ADHD, and the rights of the parents and the kids. I have a funny question for you, hopefully, to move us away from this, which is, what is the most bizarre law case that you've had to face or help fight?
So bizarre. I'm not sure I could put my hand on the most bizarre. There are episodes of things that I would call bizarre in all of my cases. You have these moments of, did that really happen? I mean, come on, right? But I'm going to answer that question by talking about the case that should have never been a case, and it just ended so well for the youngster. This was a young man who for a number of years had been in a private special education school placed by the school district because he had very severe needs, intellectual disabilities, Tourette syndrome, if you're familiar with that, that has that symptom of echolalia where, you know, the child will just blurt out things off their head and that sort of thing. And the child, once he hit high school, wanted to go to the regular high school and receive some accommodations and services there and be a part of that. The school district resisted it heavily. They wanted him to stay in that setting, but his mom was courageous and fought back. And we managed to get him, after, you know, pursuing the legal avenues, we managed to get him into the regular education school. And on the second day of school, it happened to be for them the homecoming dance, and two young women invited him to the homecoming dance. He became one of the most popular guys in school.
Aww.
Over time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
But it doesn't quite end there. When he was finally going to graduate, he wasn't going to graduate with a full diploma. He was going to get a certificate because he had these limitations and the like cognitively. The school district didn't want to let him go up on the stage, even though this was the pinnacle of his education. We had to fight. His mom fought. And he finally did get to walk. And ultimately, the principal said, you know what? This is the right thing to do, which was kind of a nice moment.
That is such a great story. I love that. Thank you, Bill. It warms our heart.
So a very different line of questioning, if that's okay. I'm a parent. I want my child to do well and to make it through college and get a good profession. And I happen to be a parent who wants my son or daughter to become a lawyer. So what is your advice for those parents who are interested in cultivating lawyerliness in their children?
My parental advice or my advice is to somebody that wants to go to school? My parental advice might be settle down.
Run away. Yeah. Say no.
Let your child figure out what she wants to do. The funny thing about preparation for law is that there isn't any clear direct path. At the law school that I teach at, we have engineers. We have people who have been in medicine. We have philosophers. We have people from all different undergraduate majors and professions out there in the real world. We have a number of vets who've come back after, serving the country, come back to school and want to do this. Biggest thing that I tell people when they ask me, hey, I want to go to law school, or my kid wants to go to law school or something like that, I say, read, read, and read some more. Write, write, and write some more. Even if you're an engineer, even if you're a scientist, maybe especially if you're an engineer or you're a scientist, you ought to start reading and writing, because this is a profession that traffics in language and words, and that's really important to really be a good reader, a good writer, deep, careful, critical reader and writer.
I think it's great advice. And I know I learned a lot today, because I didn't know that there were all these different subsets of the law that you could specialize in, working with special ed kids and making sure that their rights are enforced, for instance. So I think you have enlightened us in wonderful ways. Thank you so much for being a great guest.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. So, Denise, I think the takeaway here is tough, because I'm a parent and I'm not quite sure when I should go seek legal help. And the answer seems to be, you should go talk to the school.
I think talk to the school counselor. I think talk to a pediatrician. I think never assume that you're in it alone would be a nice bit of advice.
Boy, for life.
For life.
For life.
You are not in it alone.
No, this is a deep point. I like that.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.